water down along 25.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
All right.
Good morning, everyone. This is State Government Finance Committee, and I want to welcome everyone. We have a full agenda this morning. As we indicated the other day, what we want to do to start with here as a committee is to get an overview of some of the big picture issues that that we have facing us as a state. And this morning we're going to hear about our new accounting system and the update on that, and also the budget information system, some work that's being done in terms of internal controls, which is a very important issue across state government. And then at the end we're also going to hear from Campaign Finance Board. So that's that is the list of things we're going to do today. You have before you the proposed minutes from our last meeting, Representative Benson.
Chairman, I move that we approve.
Mr. Chairman, I approve. I make a motion to approve the minutes of January the 11th.
Any additions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Minutes are approved. Our first presenter is Ms. Lori Moe, Assistant Commissioner of MMB. Please come forward. And if you would, for the tape, indicate your name and also spell it for everyone so that they have a record of your name and being before us today. So.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Moe, L-O-R-I. Last name is just M-O. I'm Assistant Commissioner of Accounting Services at Minnesota Management and Budget. With me today is Jim Mannion, who is our project manager on the SWIFT project. He is a position that was hired specifically for the project team and came to us with lots of good experience implementing similar kind of systems. So we're happy to be here with you today and to give you an update on the SWIFT project.
Well, welcome, and thank you both for being here today. So go ahead and proceed.
Right. I hope you have the slides in your packet. I've included some background and history materials because there are a number of people on the committee that were not in this group last year when we were before you. The SWIFT project first.
Excuse me. Everyone found the material she's referring to? Everyone have a copy of that? Okay. Go ahead.
The SWIFT project, to start with the acronym, stands for Statewide Integrated Financial Tools, and it's the name that we've given our project to replace the statewide accounting and procurement system. This is an important project because the statewide accounting and procurement system is really the foundation of our financial management infrastructure. It's the system that processes all of the state's receipts and payments. It's a system not only used by MMB, but it's used by every state agency across state government. The current system has over 200,000 active vendors that are paid. This ranges everything from school aid payments, local government aids, to medical assistance and crime victim payments. This project consists of a large team, which is a combination of employees and contractors, and there's also been significant involvement from various state agencies as part of the executive committee, as part of the steering committee, as full-time project team members, and also as various subject matter experts. The primary project was to replace the accounting and procurement functionality, but after we went through an evaluation of the software products available, the software that was ultimately selected was the same product as we have used for many, many years for our HR payroll and benefits administration system. So when we're finished with this project, we're going to have a fully integrated system, and having that commonality provides some additional opportunities for a delivered data warehouse solution, as well as common portal and security functionality. So those are being implemented as well. I've included a few slides on the benefits of replacement. We have in our current system a number of significant technology risks, and the replacement will address all of those issues. It will be supported and sustainable going into the future, and it will utilize modern database and security technology. The new system will also provide better and more detailed information for decision making, and will provide more information to the public for transparency. We will also have some benefits related to efficiency in the new system. The new software provides workflow features that will allow automated processing rather than paper transactions. We will have online functionality for our vendors and customers, and it will be a web-based product, which will significantly reduce the maintenance required by all of the state agency users. The implementation such as this is a large and complex undertaking. Minnesota is, of course, a large and complex operation, and we've been managing project challenges along the way. Shortly after we signed the contract with our prime vendor, they announced their intention to sell that portion of their practice. And this created some distraction for the team for a period of time, but ultimately we agreed to the assignment of our contract to another vendor. After the transition, the new vendor had turnover in a number of positions, but they've expressed strong commitment to the project, and they moved very quickly to bring in new resources to the vacant positions. In addition, there's been a couple of the subject areas that have proven to be more complex than originally anticipated, and some replanning has been required. For example, our data warehouse release was broken down into five phases, and we worked with agencies to prioritize the release so that they would get the highest priority information the earliest. And the first release of that is expected at the end of this month. And then finally, I want to say that agency participation has really been excellent during the whole course of the project. They have been very responsive to the many assignments that we have asked them to complete to prepare for the new system. But those demands are going to continue through implementation and beyond. As you know, change can be hard, and adjusting to the new system and the learning curve associated with new processes and other changes will put additional stress on agencies. So we included in our contract with our prime vendor considerable efforts related to agency readiness, and we're doing everything we can to minimize the pressures on agencies along the way. This has been a long term project that's been in the planning for a number of years. We first received funding for planning in the 2007 session, and then the actual implementation was funded 2 years ago in the 2009 session. Since then, we've completed the planning and design phases Much of the development is complete, and we're currently in the system test phase of the project. There's still a lot of work remaining. We're monitoring the progress along with our implementation vendor closely and making additional adjustments as needed. We're currently looking at the remaining workload, system test results, and agency readiness for the transition and planning how to best deliver a high quality system with an eye to the agency preparedness. The original budget for the project was $65.8 million, and we continue to manage within the original budget. Like our current system, the ongoing operating costs will be paid in part by billings to agencies, and we're currently working with our vendor to design the post-implementation support model. That's my overview of the project. On your last slide, you'll see a link to a reference to our project website. There is a lot of additional information available there, and also I'm happy to answer questions.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Moll. Going back to the slide that you had on next major steps, do I interpret this to mean that essentially by this summer, this you're expecting this to be fully implemented? Is that
Well, as I said, we have a lot of critical steps yet to go, and I expect that we'll have some additional adjustments before we're done. But I expect core functionality will be delivered in July.
And another question I would have is, could you give a couple of examples of things that this system will enable us to do that we couldn't do before by way of reducing redundancy or improving the efficiency of operations, et cetera?
Certainly. One of the things I mentioned was the workflow functionality. This will provide improvements on a number of levels. It will improve efficiency. It will reduce paper processing. It will improve controls. It can be customized for multiple levels of approval. So, for example, when processing a payment, currently an approval is done on paper and then it's passed to the next person and it gets approved and then it gets entered and then there may be other processing. This will allow the transaction to be entered first for it to pass to the proper approvals online, so that the person who is approving it knows what they're approving has already been entered with the correct amount and payee, et cetera. It will provide for multiple levels of approval, and it will provide for varied processing dependent on dollar amount, so that high-risk kinds of transactions can go through additional approvals.
And one last question I'd have is, when this is completed, will there still be some departments that have their own separate independent system, or will, in fact, all be integrated?
Mr. Chairman, members, the system will be used by all agencies, but it certainly won't eliminate the specialized subsystems that exist at agencies. For example, Human Services operates the Medicaid Management Information System. That's a very specialized system that does claim processing, among other things, for Medicaid provider payments. That detailed level processing will continue to happen at DHS in that system, But the summary level transactions will all be captured in this system. The vendor payments will be made out of this system. And so this is the core accounting system, but specialized functions will certainly still exist.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for either testifier. I know that with the MAPS system, one of the reasons why it needed replacement was there were problems with the vendor software availability. Do you have confidence in the vendor and that we're not going to have this problem again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. This is a software vendor that has this product installed around the globe. It's a vendor that we've worked with successfully for our HR payroll benefits administration system since the mid-90s. They have released regular upgrades. For example, for our payroll processing, we get upwards of 8 tax upgrades every year so that we can stay current with tax law changes and other requirements. I expect, excuse me, that'll be one of the benefits of this new system will be that their regular upgrades will provide compliance with changing federal requirements. For example, in 2012, we have a new withholding requirement that does not exist in our legacy system.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bell, I'm interested in the Medicaid management system. How old is that and what relationship does it have to the old MMIS?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I'm not able to answer your question regarding the age of the DHS MMIS system, but it is currently...
It is the MMIS
system. Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
And it is currently interfaced with the MAPS accounting system and will continue to be with
okay.
the new system.
And so that's the same,
yes.
That's the same problem that had dramatic stories about it, you know, 10 plus 15 years ago. Is it that? You don't know how old it is. Okay.
No, we'll say.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could, actually, I have just a couple questions that I might ask in succession here. The Ms. Mo, the reference to streamlined and standardized functions, how extensively did you end up actually modifying the core application code? And secondarily, how standardized are all of these core accounting functions across the agencies? Have you had to create kind of one-off business process flows to support unique agency needs, or were you able to get all of the agencies conformed not only to the system but to the core business process and kind of the data model and those elements as well?
Ms. Moe?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, we had a rigorous process to review every single request for customization to the system. We had originally estimated the number of project requirements that would not be met by the delivered software, and the vendors that replied to our RFP estimated the areas where the delivered software would not meet our requirements. We, at that point, reduced those hours, I believe, by about 25% with the expectation that we would find different ways of doing business rather than recreate some of those existing processes. And where we are currently is that we have actually used about, and I'm going to look at Mr. Mannion here to help my memory, but I think we're about 25% again lower than that. So I feel like we have, well, certainly we still have some customization. We have made significant changes in the business processes. We were already fairly standardized across agencies, because we already had a central system, but we have found that there was more variation in some of the procurement practices than on the accounting functionality. But we have been working very hard to combine those. One agency area where we've had probably the most unique needs is in the case of DOT, where their project costing requirements are very unique within state government. And we have had a person on the, they allowed a person to come be a full-time project member and has been working on the project costing functionality. So that we want to make sure that this system will work for those requirements as well, because that would be in itself a very significant specialized subsystem if the centralized system couldn't meet their needs.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Moy, maybe this is unfair to ask you to try and put a percentage on it, but are we 50% standardized on business processes and kind of core functions, 75, 90? What's the degree of variation kind of outside the standard core out of the box or the standard functionality that you built into the core system?
I'm not sure how you measure that, but okay. I will.
Gut feel.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Downey, I'd say probably the vast majority is standardized. Certainly that's true for the financial application. Probably less so in the procurement, but the non-standardization tends to be at a lower level. The way you do the purchasing, the way you do the RECs and the payments center will be very standardized across all of the agencies. But individual agencies have sort of their own uniqueness, particularly in the procurement area. So it's hard to do a quote on this thing, but the agencies have been really very cooperative about accepting the standardization. So I think we're looking somewhere in the 75% to 90%, perhaps even better than that.
Mr. Mannion, for the tape, if you would identify yourself so we have your...
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I am Jim Mannion. I am the project manager for the SWIFT project.
Thank you. Representative Downey?
If I could, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, I don't want to dominate here, but I did have
you
a couple
questions.
You
may ask again.
Thank you. Ms. Moore, are we doing anything to actually track the kind of return on this investment? Obviously, $65 million is a significant IT investment in the state, and some expectation of efficiencies and some of the benefits that you at least talk about conceptually here should translate into, I would think, some hard and soft return on investment. What are we doing to actually track that or capture that on the back end of the project?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, there will certainly be a number of efficiencies, as I've discussed, that will occur out at state agencies. We expect that during the initial year of operation, because of the learning curve associated with the project, that there will not be significant efficiencies, and we expect that long term it's going to be difficult to measure, because it will be small pieces of many, many people's time. And what we expect is that the system will free them up to work on higher value activities, and that information available will be improved. But one of the areas where I hope in the future we will be able to have a better measurement is in some of the procurement benefits. But I don't know how quickly that'll be measurable.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment.
Send it down.
It might be good for us to think about it. I don't know if we want to necessarily do this in statute, but certainly create the expectation that over time we would start to see some kind of a measurement of the return, mm-hmm. both soft and hard dollar kinds of savings or improvements. I think that'd be real valuable for us to measure the big investment that we've made. And if I could, one final real quick question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Moe, to what extent did OET kind of fulfill their oversight, their statutory oversight role? And if you could just explain kind of how that worked, how much you budgeted for that as a charge back to them, how that worked, and maybe how it even went.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, the Office of Enterprise Technology has been active in the project in a number of ways. Their deputy has been an active participant in our project executive committee, and the head of their project management office sits on our steering committee. In addition, they ensured that our required risk assessment was completed early in the project, and we have also just recently had discussions with them about the project audit requirements for the second fiscal year.
Representative Downing?
Mr. Chair, I just want to wrap up and offer a thank you for me personally, and I think probably on behalf of the committee, to you too and your staffs. I think we all understand how tough these things are. You're bringing us a nice 10-page PowerPoint summary, but we know the level of effort and the staff time and the commitment it takes to pull these things off and succeed. So thank you, and pass that on to the rest of the team. Thanks for all the hard work.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess want to follow up and agree with Representative Downey that measuring ROI for IT projects in state government is something that this committee and me personally, and I know Keith, have been working on since we started here. And if anybody has any great ideas about how to start doing that, I think it'd be very beneficial. My question is to Ms. Moe about the funding, and I don't think you got too far into the funding mechanism that was used for this project, how well you think that's going, whether that might be applicable to other IT projects at the state level, because one of the challenges we have is that we need to replace systems. Systems can help improve efficiency and deliver a return on investment, but they're not very fun things to pay for. And I guess I wonder if we've learned any lessons thus far about this particular, I think it's a lease purchase approach.
Ms. Moe?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, yes, well, the system funding is set up so that we'll pay for the project over a period of time. We sold what are called certificates of participation. I think that has worked well. We have we had at the time of the transaction actually more favorable interest rates than were originally projected. So the total cost will be somewhat less than originally projected. Not the project cost, but the cost of that financing. This same mechanism was also used to fund the last phase of the integrated tax system. And while we've used it for other purchases, this was the first time it was used for software implementations.
Representative Winkler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moe, I think it's something that we all need to get a better handle on, because if it's working well, it's something that I think this committee should see more of it as other agencies try to roll out major projects. I think we should, my suggestion would be that some of those IT projects, even if it's something specific like human services, if they came and had a visit at this committee and had some benefit of the experience of finance for doing the financial oversight, I think mm-hmm. would be very helpful. The final thing I note on one slide here is that the post-implementation support model is in progress and that the costs, operating costs, are going to be billed to state agencies. I wonder two things. One, if you have just an idea of the scope of the post-release operational support that will be involved. And second, what discipline, I guess, there will be to make sure that we don't have a lot of post-release customization so that we get down the path of a fairly standardized product when it's released and then to a highly customized Rube Goldberg within, you know, the next 10 years.
Ms. Moll?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, in terms of post-implementation customization, I'll say we haven't gotten that far yet, but I expect we'll at least consider a model something like we've used for our HR payroll benefits administration system. Many of you may be familiar with that. It's what we call our semaphore system. We have, with that system, currently a steering committee that meets regularly and that reviews requests for customization that exceed a low threshold and require a basically a business case to be brought forward for customizations. That's how we've handled it during the course of development for the SWIFT project, so that the alternatives have to be laid out, the pros and cons of the alternatives have to be costed out, and any significant modifications have to be justified.
And then, Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up. It's a $65 million project. Do you have, I think we want to have a baseline of expectation for the post-implementation support costs, because I'm afraid if it's basically all charged out to the agencies, it's the kind of thing that can grow without your particularly being on the line to pay for all of it. So I guess you don't have it now, but I think hopefully in the next several months we'll have some clear understanding of what your expectations are for the support costs.
Ms. Moll?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, as you know, our authority for billing for the operating costs for the existing system is limited in statute, so we would need to come back here before you if we were requesting increase in that amount. And what we're trying to do now is look at the needs for that model and determine if that can be managed within the existing billing authority.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Ms. Moe, first of all, I want to join on with my colleagues, Representative Downey and Representative Winkler, in the thanks and the compliments. I think some of the questions that have been raised have pointed out the importance of having all budgeting for IT projects go through in the executive branch through OET, and in the legislative branch go through this division instead of being farmed out in all of the separate places where there's no one that really has any interest in. They want to do good things for people. They don't have any interest in doing good things with machinery or computers and so forth. The other side compliment I want to give you is to thank you for the biological accuracy of your logo as opposed to many of the other ones that have been done in state government. It actually does look like a SWIFT.
Thank you, Representative Cott. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, not a question, for the committee. And my experience, if the government agency that I worked for as a district manager, if I got $65 million in new technology, my next year's budget and the ones thereafter where it'd be impacted would be reduced by the amount that was delineated in the proposal for the return on investment. I think it behooves this committee to understand that going forward, when we have that kind of investment in new technology for any agency that we have control over, that we insist on seeing a return on investment and a cut in their budget in the preceding years. Thank you.
Any other questions for these folks? Mr. Mannion, did you have anything further that you wanted to share with the committee?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think Ms. Moe has answered it, everything just fine.
Any other questions? This initiative is a very good and important initiative for the state of Minnesota to improve our operating efficiency, and And I certainly compliment you on the work that's been done to this point. And I guess one last question I have is, do you anticipate the legislature needing to take any action in the foreseeable future to help make this thing finally come together and be accomplished? The question, of course, the first question would be about budget. If there's any anticipated, going to be any anticipated need for additional funding here along the way, or any anticipated legislative action that might be required here?
Mr. Chairman, as I indicated, while I expect we're going to continue to make adjustments to our project plan as we move along through these final phases of the project, I expect we'll manage those within our existing budget. And as I mentioned, on the operating cost side, we are also looking there and hoping to do that within the existing authority. But on a more of a policy perspective, we had, going into this project, expected that we might need to come before you to ask for changes in statute related to the functionality, the business processes, and to avoid some of the customizations that Representative Downey was asking about. The one that was sort of at the top of our list is the way we process our sales tax payments to ourselves, and we have actually found a solution within the delivered software, and so do not need to come before you to request that change. So at this time, I don't expect to.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly understand the value of having operational costs down the road parceled out to all the departments that are benefiting, but I share the concern that has been expressed by other members here that it's easy to lose track of that in an overall big picture, and I think it's very important that we keep the big picture in front of us here to keep a handle on what those costs really are. And to make sure that we are getting the return on investment. We've made a major commitment here in investment, and I think it's very important that we track our return on that investment as we go forward. So with that, thank you very much, and we wish you the best. And let me say, if there are problems that arise, let us know so that we can be aware of it. The last thing legislators want to do is have something to read something in the paper about a problem that we haven't been made aware of. So please keep us informed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next presentation has to do with the new budget information system. And if those testifiers would come forward. Ms. Dibdahl, if you would identify yourself for the tape. And
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Kristen Dibdahl, State Budget Director. I'm happy to come provide you with an update on our budget replacement system project today. Certainly a smaller project than the one that Ms. Moe was referencing earlier, but one we're finding equally complex. I guess there are lots of new members, so just for a little context, what we're talking about today and what you should have in your packet is an outline of some of our comments that we want to make today. We're really talking about the Biennial Budget Information System, BIS. And that includes both the biennial budget system, the capital budget system, and the fiscal note tracking system. The new project we're talking about today really involves the biennial budget system. So that is the system that we began using this fall, really to populate all the base budget information in preparation for the operating budget that will be coming out in February. So we use that through the fall to populate base budget information. We also use it to track the changes to that base budget that the governor would recommend. And we use it to publish the biennial budget that will come out on February 15th. We are going to use our current system one last time this year to produce the governor's operating budget. We began working on a replacement for this particular system about 3 years ago, at least conceptually, began working on it. And the need to replace the budget system was really based on our agency's assessment that this system had a high level of business risk associated with it. It's 20 years old. The technology is very outdated, and it hasn't been updated for many, many years. And in addition, the expertise on sort of the programming that one would have to do to make modifications no longer exists. It's not at MMB. Folks that were really familiar with this system have already retired. And it's just not in keeping with some of the advances that are out there right now. In addition, as I referenced before, the system is static. So essentially what that means is that we only use it every 2 years. You know, late summer, early fall, we crank up the system, we load it with data, we analyze the data, agencies set their base budgets, we go through the governor's process where we're contemplating changes and publishing a budget. And then within a couple of months, the information is essentially irrelevant. So the vision that we really had for replacing the system was that we would develop a budgeting system that would be used as a real-time budgeting tool, not just for MMB, not just for legislative fiscal staff, but for agency staff, so that they could really streamline all of the side systems that we know that they're using to manage their daily budgets. I guess the last thing I would say, just as an introduction, is that when we began working on this project, the SWIFT project was conceived. We were working on it at MMB, but it wasn't funded. So we kind of started work on this project prior to the accounting system and the accounting system being funded. And so as the SWIFT project was funded, we also recognized that we weren't going to be able to use our current system and reprogram that to be compatible with the new accounting system. So any questions so far on kind of why we decided to go down this path or the current system?
So if I understand you correctly, that we're going to use the existing system for this budget that's coming up now for the next biennium, but that work would continue on the new system, and that would not be operational until the subsequent biennial budget. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And there, we have heard that there's some real anxiety about this new system. Can you say something about what's being done to address people's anxiety, departmental anxiety over this new system?
Mr. Chair, maybe if I walk through kind of the stages of our development quickly so you understand kind of how we started the project and where we are today, that might help illuminate some of those issues. We entered into a contract with a consulting firm in the summer of 2008 and started working on this project. And the consultant's work really ended at and was completed at the end of 2009. And so beginning last January, so like a year ago, we really had a prototype system. And we were recognizing that we had lots of technology problems with that prototype system. We had very slow batch processes to accommodate some of our technical limitations. I would say that some of the way that the system was set up wasn't as user-friendly as we would have liked it to be from an agency perspective. And so our agency spent probably 6 to 7 months really trying to see if we could make some improvements to the system from a technology standpoint, get it running faster and things like that. Probably by the fall of this year, we realized that the prototype that we had was really not going to meet the vision that we had outlined at the outset of the project. It really was not going to allow us to produce this real-time budgeting tool that we had envisioned. And the major problems with that had to do with the selected software we're using, Cognos, is really unable to handle the size and the complexity of state government. So the number of agencies we have, the accounts, the level of detail that individual agencies want to be able to have at their fingertips and to use. And we, in our initial vision, had really tried to accommodate agencies' requests for a lot of flexibility within the system, decentralized flexibility, to make account changes, organizational changes, and that sort of thing. And it really stretched the limits of the technology that we have purchased. So, and I should introduce, I'm sorry, I should introduce Michelle Weber. She's our project manager. She started this September. So kind of as we were going through this process of saying, okay, what do we have? Is this going to meet our needs? Where we are right now is that we're looking at whether or not we can take Cognos and bundle it with some other complementary software tools and expand the functionality of it, and at the same time rescope the business requirements. I believe we have been a little too aggressive in terms of what we think the system can accomplish. So we have to look at those two things together. The other avenue is really to consider whether there might be other options out there, other applications that can more robustly achieve what we were hoping to achieve at the onset. So that's really where we are in terms of the project.
So if I understand correctly, that you found the original prototype wasn't meeting our needs, wasn't going to work, and now you're trying to find a different model or different prototype as to what you might put together to move forward, and that has resulted in our having to just keep with what we have now for the next biennium, and instead work to try and redo this for the following biennium. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I should also mention that we were going to, because of SWIFT, we knew we were going to have to make significant changes to the prototype anyway. That, as you heard, is going to be up and running in its core form in July. And so for us to actually go live with a new budget system was going to require us to make some adaptations to the new accounting system, too. So,
thank you. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to follow through on the Office of Enterprise Technology review of large projects under Subdivision 3. And I guess I'd like to know, there are three levels of review that we have based on what the total cost of the project is expected to be. And I'm not sure if this fits into the, certainly fits into the over $1 million. I'm not sure if it fits into the over $5 million, but I'd like to, for the total, that's not a biennial cost, that's a total cost issue. So I'd just kind of like to know what the OET's efforts, activities have been in the review and controls on this project.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Michelle Weber, and as Ms. Dibdahl mentioned, I'm the new project manager for the budget system. As Ms. Dibdahl mentioned, we issued an RFP, I believe, in 2007, and we worked with the Office of Enterprise Technology at that time to develop a risk assessment for the project, as well as help us with the scoping of the project and the development of the RFP. We have also filed project plans and have recently been in communication with OET about how they might help us in moving forward.
Well,
Representative Kahn,
what has the answer been then in terms of the review of these issues and in the integration with the other ones?
Ms. Weber. Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, in terms of a formal review of the project at this point, that has not been completed by OET.
No.
We do file annual updates with them on our project, and so we recently filed one for this year.
Representative Kahn?
Well, I guess I'm interested in looking at the amount of money that's been spent already of the two. Are you sure this isn't going to get into the expectation of the over $5 million for the total project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, to date, we have spent $2.5 million on the project. That included about $1.3 million in the technology carry forward from MMB. We also received contributions from MnDOT and DHS in the amount of $600,000 each. And we're, as I mentioned before, we're looking at a couple of different options. One is utilizing the Cognos software with some complementary applications that are lower cost applications, but we still probably need some additional consulting time. And then looking at what other options might be out there. I don't anticipate that this will go over $5 million, but
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, we're currently in the process of assessing what are the financial implications moving forward, depending on which direction we take with the system. And over the course of time, depending on our internal resources versus those in which we have to contract out, we don't yet have a good cost estimate for moving forward.
Okay. Well,
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, I assume, does that $5 million or ten, those different thresholds that we have in there, does that also include the bill backs to the agencies, or is it just appropriated funds?
Ms. Dibdahl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not familiar with that, but maybe someone from OET could help.
Well, I guess I'd specifically like, and obviously not take up the committee time now, but there is a section that applies to everything, of 16E.0465. And I would really like some kind of a detail about how 16E.0465 is being followed in this appropriation.
Okay, great.
I don't know. Because I know we did have a problem once where we had the finance department believing that these that this language, which is awfully specific about what they're supposed to do, they kind of considered it sort of advisory, that it was a good idea if they looked at that. And so I'd like to follow through on that.
We'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a whole bunch of questions, which probably goes beyond what you have time for on the agenda today.
Representative Winkler, I think we probably will have another 10-15 minutes at most on this subject. And I think you can tell from what's been said already that we need to come back to this. We need to follow the development of this, because this information is absolutely critical as we do budgeting going forward. And obviously we haven't found the answer here yet. And I know these things are very difficult to do, and oftentimes end up costing a whole lot more than what you had anticipated or expected. But this is very, very important. So go ahead, Representative Winkler, but we'll have to shift gears here in about 10-15 minutes.
Sure. Mr. Chair, for either of the testifiers, I guess my first question is, it seems that the Cognos system was at its root not suited for the project that you had in mind. And you mentioned that there was a consulting firm involved, and I wonder how it was that the Cognos system was selected, and whether there's any opportunity for a clawback. If this system was fundamentally not suited for its purpose, is there a way that we can recover any of the money that's been spent already?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, we did select Cognos as a result of a fairly extensive RFP process, and I truly believe that at the time it was really was the best software alternative for us. I guess all I can say is that I think both M&B and our consulting partners probably underestimated the complexity and the scope of what we were trying to accomplish at that time. And I also think that as an agency, we probably underestimated our ability to provide resources and time to support the implementation of such a large project. For example, I was at a conference this summer talking to North Carolina, and they are implementing a similar suite of products, and they have a budget that's not too dissimilar from our budget. And they were spending $7 million on this type of an effort and devoting over 20 of their budget staff resources to the project on an almost full-time basis. So I think, you know, one of the things that we've learned quite clearly is that a project like this does take resources and does take staff time. Very difficult to accomplish that within the budget division when we have other competing priorities coming up, like federal stimulus reporting and unallotment processes and all kinds of things like that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
Representative Winkler?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the foundational question asked, which is there an inherent limitation in Cognos that has prevented it from serving the needs for this project, or is Cognos the best there is? But surely other states have budget systems and probably newer ones than ours. So yeah. What's unique about this project that made it ill-suited for the software that was selected?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Representative Bill? Winkler, I think the core technical issues related to all of our problems has to do with the size and the accounts and the level of detail that we and the flexibility that we were envisioning the system to have. I think in other states they've made very top-down, sort of centralized decisions about, we're only tracking things at this level, and we're only allowing variation, you know, to this degree. Our vision was a very decentralized vision. We wanted everyone to have access to everything. And I think that is incompatible with the Cognos software as we have it right now.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could
Ms. Weber.
Expand a bit. Representative Winkler, in addition to, in follow-up to your previous question, the proposals in response to our request for proposals were initially significantly higher than the financial resources we had available. So as a portion of negotiating the contract and a cost in which the state could afford, we then took on additional responsibilities at the state level, which then decreased the work that would be achieved by the outside vendor as we had initially anticipated. In addition, we just stretched Cognos beyond what it's intended to do. We wanted things like document production in our current budget system and the way we currently produce the budget. We have a lot of narrative information that agencies provide and background context for folks going into their budget, and that's one of the aspects of the system that was recognized early on that it's not good for that, but we were trying to see if there was a way we could make the system do what we needed it to do.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to
Winkler.
Kind of a summary then. You have SWIFT project, which is a $65 million project in your agency, critically important as well, a big cost item. Your agency also needed essentially a budget system, which is separate but needs to plug into the accounting system. And you had a vision for what you hoped to for that it would achieve, the budget system would achieve. You didn't feel that you could request higher level of funding from the legislature or authority for a lease purchase or whatever it is, and so you've used carry forward money and money from other agencies to try to get the project up and running, but to actually realize the vision of what you've started down, it would cost significantly more than what you felt like you could ask for, and or at least whatever decision there was to ask for it or not, and so I guess you face a question of whether you scale back the vision for the project, or whether you continue to try to make cheaper software stretch to fit the need.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I think that's essentially correct. I would say, along with continuing down the path of using the existing software that we've purchased and the prototype that we've developed, if we went down that path, I think necessarily we're going to have to scale back the business requirements that we initially envisioned.
Mr. Chair, I guess my final comment is
I think
it's legitimate for the legislative body, for us, our committee, and the rest of the legislature to be involved in the decision-making about whether the fully built-out, fully envisioned model for the budget system is worth the money or not, and whether we are willing to engage in a way to find money to pay for it.
Point well taken. Representative Anderson.
I'll pass it this time.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Winkler covered a number of the things that I would have. First, just a response to Representative Kahn's question. In 16E.01, it says that the project cost of more than $1 million, whether funded as part of the biennial budget or by any other means. So I think that would imply all of the chargebacks. So it's the aggregate project cost, regardless of the source of the funding. And then just based on some prior experiences, there is no optimal off-the-shelf budgeting solution in the marketplace right now that maps very effectively to large public scale environments. There's two, there's Cognos and there's Hyperion, and they both have limitations, and I think I agree with the final assessment here that you can only bake so much into those off-the-shelf budgeting solutions. They're typically better as aggregators and reporters as compared to doing the very detailed budget formulation work, and so I concur with Representative Winkler that it might be helpful for this committee or an appropriate subgroup to spend some time and think through that assessment with the agency.
Very, very interesting. Maybe there's an entrepreneurial opportunity here for someone given the needs so many states have for improving their whole budgeting process that maybe some firm out there can get started or going on trying to come up with something that is a more optimal system. Representative Kahn.
Well, having listened to this very informative session yesterday, maybe we should use the Helsinki model and put a suggestion out that someone supply it to us absolutely free to be used as a model around the country.
I like that idea. It's a good idea. Further questions? Part of the committee.
Let me
just ask, obviously we haven't found the solution yet, and a lot more work is going to be needed. Can you talk about the kind of consultations that you're engaged in with the folks who really depend upon this, like our House and Senate fiscal analysts, for example? to what extent are you engaged or in a consultative process here to get input from the people who really need this new system?
Mr. Chair, I think given all the work that's gone on and in our attempt to kind of finish this project and get it done, we have, I think, over the last year or so, probably neglected the communications piece. This fall, I recognized that folks were dissatisfied with some of the communication, and we were at a point, a decision point, where we had information to share on, you know, we really don't believe this prototype system is going to do what we need it to do, and we felt, as an organization, we felt comfortable saying that, and we did begin communications, I guess, again, in a very earnest way. And we're really interested in continuing that and getting the dialogue, continuing the dialogue, because I think, as I've talked about, and as your members have referenced, there isn't an ideal out-of-the-box technology solution, and so we have to jointly make some decisions about which, you know, what level and what type of data we're going to collect and track. We can't do it all. So I think you've highlighted a really essential communication loop.
Well, I appreciate very much your straightforward answer to answers to questions that we've been asked today. And that's very important as we struggle to try and work through this and find the solution. And I would like for you folks to keep us posted, and we can get you back on the agenda at any point in which you have a need for some feedback and reaction to where things stand. This is a very important activity, and we want to get it right going forward. So thank you for being here today, and stay in touch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will next move to the issue of internal controls. Okay. Yeah. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for allowing me to come today and talk about internal control, my favorite topic. My name is Janine Kuick. My last name is K-U-W-I-K, and I'm the Director of Internal Control and Accountability with MMB.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Okay. You should have in your packets a variety of different things, hopefully some slides, that start by saying the history of internal control legislation. Excuse me. I thought I would give some background about our mission and how we came to be. Our legislation was included in the governor's 2010-2011 budget recommendations and was passed by the legislature in the 2009 session. It allowed for up to 6 staff for internal control, and that's how we are currently staffed, myself and 5 staff. We are mostly former auditors, including myself. I was a long-term audit manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And we kind of serve as, it's interesting, as former auditors, we serve as more management consultants. If you know much about how the Office of the Legislative Auditors work, they actually are a post-audit function. They are to be independent, and so they can't get really involved too much with management's processes or management's resolution of issues. So as former auditors, we appreciate the fact that we can pull up to the table with the management and can help them resolve issues. So we really believe that by the time the OLA comes up with control weaknesses or a fraud or something's been uncovered, that's too late. Our mission is to try to get agencies and management to be more proactive, to be able to really look at their processes, look at their controls, and be more on the prevention or detection side long before something happens that's going to create a problem for people. Just again, as some background, if you look at the next slide, I kind of have highlighted the 16A.057 responsibilities that we have. I think also in your packet you have actually a copy of the legislation to refresh your memory. We actually are charged with adopting statewide internal control standards and policies, coordinating agency training and assistance, coordinating and sharing internal audit resources, monitoring OLA reports and issues, and reporting biennially on the state system of internal controls. So I thought I would spend a few minutes today kind of highlighting our training and outreach. We have several things. We have all my staff and myself have kind of our training and sales hat clearly on our heads in trying to sell the point of internal control, and also in trying to help agencies understand kind of the link between the theoretical internal control literature, which most people look at that and their eyes kind of roll back and say, what does this really mean to all of us in state agencies in the state of Minnesota? So one of the first things that we launched when I accepted this position in August of 2009 was something that we call the Internal Control Bulletin. And hopefully some of you are familiar with this. I didn't include a copy in here. This is the most recent edition. It's posted on our website. It comes out every month. And these bulletins are really monthly reminders to agencies and to management about their control responsibilities. They also are on a very selected small topic that hopefully agency management can get their arms around and can say, what does this mean to us in our agency? Part of these control bulletins, we always have suggested action steps. So we have real life things that agencies can do to try to think right here and now, how can we improve our internal controls? We also have developed a lot of guidance and tools. We believe that a lot of the internal control talk, especially the theoretical talk that the auditors do, they really mean things to agency folks, but the problem is in the translation between the theory and what does it really mean to agency folks. So you also have kind of a long document like this, and if you look at the front of it, it's actually called the Agency-Wide Control and Environment Self-Assessment Tool. And if I could just point that out, this is one of the early things that we did for agencies. And if you would humor me, if you would go to page 6 of 11, what this document did is provide agency folks with 20 goals of good agency behavior. And those goals are really linked to the theoretical body of knowledge for internal control. But what we really wanted to do is link these goals to things that actually occur and information and laws, statutes that occur already in the state of Minnesota. So if you will humor me, goal number 11 here on page 6 says management ensures that agency information is appropriately protected against loss, corruption, and misuse. You know, we can all nod our heads and say that's a very good goal. But what we did with this document, if you move all the way over to column H, we have actually linked this to real life information and real life existing requirements that you folks as legislators have put on agencies. You were way ahead of your time. You knew about control environment in a theoretical, in a real life sense long before we talked about it in a theoretical sense. Obviously, there's all kinds of things that you have already done as a body to help promote those good behaviors at agencies. So if you look at the references on CalmH, we have statutes regarding data practices, regarding government records. We also have Minnesota rules. We have some OET statements where they're talking about how do you protect computer resources and computer information that exists. We have MMB operating policies. So we're trying to say these concepts that the theory talks about are really not that foreign. We have all kinds of things that already exist in the state to help you, and what we're trying to do is link those things together and tell agency management, when auditors come and ask you about control environment, there's all kinds of things that you do already that really are relevant to this discussion, but you maybe just haven't linked all of these maybe seemingly disparate things together and say all of these things come together to make a good, healthy organization that's well-controlled. We also are doing pilot projects out in agencies on risk assessments. We've done lots of site visits and speaking engagements. And then we perhaps maybe put our audit hat on a little more on a couple of the next things. We were asked by MMB management to become involved in ERA. And you know that ERA was a huge initiative. The 1512 quarterly reporting, the website transparency stuff was very, very important to the state. And so we actually did some audit work in that on behalf of the state to make sure that we were had ourselves in a good position and we had good internal controls in that area. We also are actively involved in SWIFT. Some of the things that Ms. Mo talked about were workflow, which means online approvals and online verifications of things. We are, according to the consultants, only one of two implementation projects currently going on where we have control presence and kind of a early audit presence that we're doing, looking at how they are determining who gets access to the system, who in agencies are actually going to be allowed to do what within the system as kind of an early look. We know the more controls that are hard baked into the SWIFT system, the better it's going to operate. In the past environment with MAPS, a lot of the controls were handing off paper from one person to the next to the next. A lot of the worked, the SWIFT controls will be worked into the system. The system will never get tired. If it doesn't like it the first time, it won't like it the 10th time or the 20th time. It won't just allow things to pass through if it doesn't pass certain controls. So we are very positive about the option or the intent for SWIFT to provide much better control transactions within the state. We also are spending quite a bit of time with the state's internal auditors. As you may be aware, several of the state agencies have dedicated internal audit professionals that they employ. However, right now there is no mandate in statute for state agencies to have internal auditors. I think they're getting the message. I think the internal audit presence is growing, but we are really helping facilitate and having those folks network. Many of the internal audit staffs are single person shops, so they need us and they need each other to as networking opportunities to help them be successful in their work as well. So as of December 15th, 2010, we actually had 43 internal audit professionals in the executive branch. And actually, as we speak, we're having a roundtable meeting. My staff is with the internal audit group, talking about issues, talking about internal controls and common audit issues that they can share. So I guess those are my preliminary remarks. I would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Kuwick. First question I guess I would have is, could you talk about the process whenever a breach does occur, where you become aware of some control problem in a particular agency or department? To what extent do you then sort of do the kind of analysis as to what went wrong, what needs to be done to correct this?
Mr. Chair, members, a very good question. Luckily, we have had lots of discussions with agencies where they believe they have weaknesses or control gaps, but they have not identified anything in particular that has gone wrong. which is the best way. That's the way that we're trying to get agencies to think about this, to identify their own gaps. Then we serve more as consultants. We are really trying very hard to not, as a staff of six, to not provide agencies with fish, but to teach them how to fish. So we are actively engaged with many agencies in providing consultation, talking about risks, talking about control gaps, and working through for them how they might be able to resolve those issues and put the types of controls in place that they need to put into place.
So you're saying that it's more of a preventative kind of model as opposed to a forensics model, going in and identifying the particular things that did go wrong and what needs to be fixed. Am I understanding you correctly?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Then whose role is it to do the forensics part of this?
Mr. Chair, members, we do get involved in some of those if, in fact, there has been a breach and there has been a fraud. We also oftentimes work very closely with the Legislative Auditor's Office. If those breaches become public information, they are also very involved in doing kind of the forensics. And if, in fact, it ends up to be a case where there could be charges filed, they have subpoena power. They're more equipped to be able to gather the types of evidence that's needed to be able to press charges against the guilty parties.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kuwick, since 2009, you've been dealing with agencies. I'm just wondering what kind of feedback you have from these agencies that you're dealing with, and do these agencies have a liaison that works with you as regarding within their own agency for internal control and internal auditing situations that, you know, I'm sure that as the OLA has dealt with them throughout past years, do they now come along with the fact that you are kind of another watchdog on the list, and is there a, I take it there's an annual report back to you from each of the agencies, but I'm not sure.
Ms. Kuwick?
Chair, Representative Anderson, we are actually still kind of forging those relationships. We actually have a couple of different vehicles that we use. We are, in fact, present at the table at all the legislative audit exit conferences. As an observer, part of our mission is to monitor legislative audit issues and work towards the resolution of those findings. So we find it very helpful to be at the table with the agencies and the auditors in those discussions to try to assist agencies after the fact in working through those. We also have, again, liaisons with the internal auditors within the agencies. Oftentimes those are our key contacts, but as I said, those are uneven because all executive branch agencies don't have auditors, have internal auditors. We also have been reaching out to the executive management of these organizations, most specifically the deputy commissioner groups. I've met with that group on several occasions, and also the chief, the CFOs, the chief financial officers. It's in different places. Different agencies are in different places with both their internal control awareness and also their maturity and their sophistication with this. We find that some are very mature, and we can just provide kind of ad hoc guidance. We find that some need a lot more, and we're in working much more in detail with those folks to kind of get them up to speed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. If I could follow up, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kuwick, in your experience with the agencies that in the short time that you've been in existence, can you give us an example of maybe where the biggest challenge is in regarding this? I take it that with not having someone in an agency, that might be a challenge of them coming. And is there a resistance from some of these agencies that maybe, you know, because they haven't had internal audit, all of a sudden now you come in and go, we would like to see that you have this situation set up. Just some of the challenges that you see working with this broad expansion of being kind of a watchdog.
Ms. Kuwick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would say probably it's like the old Dickens story, probably our existence at this time is at the best of times and at the worst of times. I think because of the budget pressure, there has been probably the biggest challenge that we see is, you know, downsizing lots of people, consolidating. You know, there's really a need at this point to make things efficient. In some regards, internal controls are not totally efficient, because if you think about it, we are looking for checks and balances. We're looking for more than one person involved in the process. And if you look at it in its purest sense, you would say, why do I have to send this documentation to someone else to look at? You know, why can't I just do it myself? That's the most efficient. But yet, we know there has to be a separate set of eyes. We know there has to be checks and balances. And that we are concerned with the budget, that people not lose sight of the fact that there needs to be checks and balances in the system. We also want to make sure that people are smart about the kinds of controls they put into place. Because I think in the past, maybe they got dinged by the auditors or whatever, let's just put one more process in place, one more process. And in some regards, this has become maybe kind of a patchwork and hasn't been well thought out. So one of the things we're really looking at with agencies is saying, you know, what are the one or two key controls that you have that you really need to hang your hat on? Maybe you do lots of other things, but in the whole scheme of things, those are not as important as maybe the one or two key things. Let's be smart about having the controls in place that are going to do the job, but that are going to do the job the most efficiently that we can do it. So I would say the ongoing budget pressures are probably one of the things that agencies are really grappling with, balancing good control with top efficiency.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I mean, the process is good. You're doing a lot of promotion of internal controls, but we all know, you know, the ones that hit the press was $2 million. Mm-hmm. Is how do cases like that slip through the cracks? And is there a way to catch them sooner? I think of that one, and I think, remember the guy in the that was processing driver's licenses, and he had access at home, and he would go in and look up his neighbors or, you know, other people's licenses. Is Minnesota any? Is there sort of a frequency when we have these cases compared to other states? I know that for welfare, there's a whole welfare fraud investigation unit, and, you know, they're pretty on top of that. And in any group of people, I guess there's somebody that's going to try to take advantage of the system. But we hope that when you're a state employee, that you're not going to do that. So any comments on how did that get so large, and what happens in those kinds of cases to make sure that isn't going to happen again?
Ms. Kuwick?
Great question, Mr. Chair, Representative. You know, we ponder that as well. This fraud had, and again, I don't have a lot of the details on this. I am not a part of the investigation of the revenue situation. I think that's in the hands of the OLA, the BCA, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's my understanding that revenue has lots of controls in place. Obviously, there was a control breakdown here somewhere. It is kind of interesting. One of the things that was referenced is the new tax system, the Gen Tax. It is very interesting to find out that this person was exploiting the legacy tax system and increasingly was being squeezed down to what she could do because of the controls being weaker in the legacy system, which I think we see as part of what happens. It's hard because controls can look good on paper, but not necessarily be able to be completely good in practice. One of the things, if you think about the one common thing that we talk about is the fraud triangle. There's usually three things present at the time that fraud occurs. Someone has a perceived need, and that is a very personal thing. That could be an addiction. It could be a lifestyle issue or whatever. You also have a person that can rationalize this in their own mind. They can say, well, I didn't get a raise for a long time. I'm overworked. I mean, that clearly is a concern to us here in state government as things go forward. The third part of this is the opportunity. And the opportunity means, was there a control breakdown? Was there a weakness that actually allowed this person to do the mischief as much as they wanted to do it. What we're trying to do is really decrease the opportunity. And obviously, in this case, there was an opportunity for this person to do something that they should not have been doing. And what good control does is minimize, not completely eliminate, but minimize those opportunities for people to be able to do that kind of mischief. Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
Do you see that we're in line with what's happening sort of nationally, or does Minnesota have any higher rate of this type of fraud, or any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, it's hard to say exactly what. The only thing we can track is those that hit the paper, and so we are ongoing looking and tracking these kinds of occurrences in other states. Both to kind of see what lessons we can learn to give agencies here heads up if things have happened elsewhere. One of the big things we're tracking right now are the instances of fraud in the ERA money, and we're providing that information to our state agency people saying, this is what happened in another state, heads up, and look at your own processes to make sure that you have this covered. But I would say just my gut reaction is that we're no worse, and in some cases probably substantially better than what we see. We have a better control consciousness here, I think, in the state of Minnesota than some other states. That's just my gut feeling. I don't really have any sure evidence to point that out. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I just want to give a quick second of committee history on this issue. The internal controls group that we have in front of us now, as we said, was created in 2009 session. It was in part because in 2009 we learned that the Department of Finance then had no auditors left on staff, and that we, at that time, we were seeing problems not just at revenue as we see now, but there was MnDOT had significant challenges, Human Services, DNR, and even a lot of small agencies and boards like the Perpich Center and the Boxing Commission all had significant internal audit challenges. And so, and the other piece of history, I guess, that's relevant is that during the last 10 years or so, the Department of Finance lost about a third of its staff. So as that staff decreased, one of the byproducts of that was eliminating all of the auditors. And that's why this is a new function that has been created and why their work is just getting started. And I think what we're seeing at revenue is more of a legacy of a time when internal controls were weakened all across major state agencies. But I think going forward, we're going to be in a much better position.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Kuick. And we will have you come back again sometime and talk further about this subject. Thank you for being here. We have one last item on our agenda for today to hear from Campaign Finance Board, Mr. Goldsmith. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And both I and the board thank you for an opportunity to meet with you this morning. This is an overview and an introduction to the board. This is not the presentation that we'll probably make at some later time about the board's budget itself. First of all, as I said, my name is Gary Goldsmith. I think most of you, or at least many of you, have talked to me already. I want you to know that I typically answer on my own phone. I'm there from 7:30 in the morning until 4 typically, later some nights. And so if you have any questions, call me. If your experience has been good with the board, I appreciate that. If it hasn't, I hope we can hear from you. I'd also like to introduce somebody who's in the audience, who's another important member of the board, and I'll ask Jeff to stand up. This is Jeff Sigurdsson. Mr. Sigurdsson is the assistant director of the board, and when I'm not available, he does everything that I do. And if it should happen that I'm not available to appear at one of your hearings, Mr. Sigurdsson would appear on behalf of the board. What I'd like to cover in the few minutes, in about 10 minutes, is sort of a capsule of my 25-minute presentation to tell you just a little bit about the board, a few facts and figures, a peek at what we hope to be talking about during this legislative session, and then a little bit, if we have time, about public subsidy and the concept of campaign finance regulation. The board's been around for a long time, since 1974, actually, which is around the Watergate era, and that's when the federal government first started regulating campaign finance. At that time, it was the Minnesota State Ethics Commission was the name of the board. Later became the Minnesota Ethical Practices Board, and then in the 90s it was changed to its current name. The board actually is six people that are appointed by the governor. In fact, right now all six were appointed by Governor Pawlenty because they serve four-year terms, and since he's been around, was around for 8 years, he had an opportunity to appoint all those members. Unlike any other appointee, each member is approved by both the House and the Senate. So these, Governor Dayton will have two appointments to make, presumably this year. They will appear before the State Government Operations Committee in the House, and then each of you will have an opportunity to vote on those members in your body, and they have to be approved by a 60% majority. We happen to have a couple of attorneys on the board, a couple of people who are non-attorneys. One's in management, another operating manager of the Basilica of St. Mary's, and we always have two former legislators, one from each of the two major parties typically. From a staff standpoint, we have a staff of eight. We used to have nine, but we decreased that through some efficiencies that we were able to build into our operation, and we're able to eliminate a front-end sort of reception, public greeting, and general support staff person in favor of some efficiencies that we were able to accomplish, and I will maybe talk a little bit more about those as I go along. We operate a lot like I think a corporation would. We try to operate like a business. The board serves as a board of directors. They meet monthly. They set policy. They provide direction to staff. And they make the important decisions. For example, decisions on complaints, adopting administrative rules, approving advisory opinions, and so on. On a day-to-day basis, the staff runs the board. And in those operations, that's where I come in trying to make the board efficient, try to save the state money where we can. We're a very small agency, so our opportunities to do that are somewhat limited, but we do things such as leasing efficient copiers, using recycled toner, print our own business cards. One of our major efforts this year, during this current fiscal year, will be to change our phone system from the old phone system that uses the 296 numbers to the internet-based phone system, which is now standard for state agencies. There's some upfront costs, but after those are covered, it'll be about a 40% per year savings on cost of the phone system. It's not always cheaper to do things with outside vendors, but where it is, we do that, and in fact, we partner a lot with OET. I think one of the best programs that OET has come up with is its Microsoft Enterprise Licensing Program, where for only $130 per seat in our office and for all state agencies, we get the absolute most current version of Microsoft Windows products. It's been a great savings for us and I think for everybody that participates, which I think is all state agencies. Another legislative endeavor that occurred a few years ago that we've taken part in and we think is a wonderful program is called the SMART program. It stands for Small Agency Resource Teams. The Department of Administration was funded for some additional positions in both human resources and in finance to support small agencies in particular. And once I became the executive director of the board about 3 years ago, we joined that program immediately. That helped us with the elimination of that one position I talked about that we were able to eliminate. That was an office manager position because we were able to transfer all of our human resources functions to the SMART team and have now achieved transfer of at least all the transactional processing of our financial management operations to that team as well. There are two results. Number one, it helped us cut down on staff and absorb budget cuts. Number two, it made our operations much more professional. The SMART teams are consultants to the small agencies, and we value them greatly for that reason, and we recommend that that program be continued. In fact, one of the board's recommendations, which were just approved at the meeting on Monday, is that we recommend the legislature continue to fund those SMART teams because they're very beneficial to small agencies. Just a couple of numbers to give you a sense of what the eight people on our staff do. We looked at this current election year up through the pre-general election report, so there's quite a bit more activity after that that isn't in these figures. Remember that the pre-general election reports only cover up to 2 weeks before the general election, so any spending after that is not going to be included. We had more than 1,500 registered entities filing reports with us. Total contributions processed into our system so far for this year, $68.5 million. Total expenditures, 44.6, not counting independent expenditures, and another $12 million in independent expenditures. Our agency is responsible for managing, for monitoring and regulating all of that incoming money, all of that outgoing money, really for two reasons. One, it's mostly the people's money. It's mostly money that people give voluntarily to candidates, party units, and other entities. If it's not the people's money, then it's the people's money because it comes through the public subsidy program, which comes from the general fund of the state. So in any case, it's public money, and I think the legislature over the years and the public in general has expected that somebody will be watching over to make sure that that money is both raised and spent in appropriate ways. Those ways are dictated by the legislature through Chapter 10A. The board exists really, according to its mission statement, and I believe this statement, I really think it's true, to promote public confidence in state government decision-making through these programs of disclosure and regulation. People are confident of their elected officials if they know they aren't in the pocket of some special interest, if they know where the money came from and where it went. There's going to be no question that these officials act independently or act only in the interest of their constituencies and not in the interest of some big moneyed interest. That was not the case in the 70s when campaign finance regulation first came into play. This session, we will make some recommendations to the legislature, mostly to the policy committees. They'll be aimed at streamlining campaign finance compliance and at providing better service to our customers. I won't go into those because we'll have hearings where we do, but just for an example, streamlining includes things such as raising registration thresholds at various entities to keep those smallest of entities, including candidates, out of the system, so that where there's such a small amount of money involved that the public interest isn't sufficient to merit getting these people into a complicated system, we recommend they be allowed to stay out. We won't be coming to this committee for any more money, I can certainly say that. We will be advocating for a sufficient budget to maintain our 8 staff members, and being such a small agency, our budget is almost all staff, personnel costs. Finally, just a couple of minutes, and I know I'm almost out of time, but I'll spend maybe 3 minutes talking about public subsidy, because this is going to be a topic that you'll hear about. I know that the bill to repeal the contribution refund program, which is temporarily suspended, has been referred to the Taxes Committee, so I'm not sure if that will come before this committee. But the problem in the 70s was there were literally bags of money being delivered around, and votes were being done. It was a scandal, and the federal government started regulating at that time, and so did the state of Minnesota. An important case came down in 1976 called Buckley versus Vallejo. It was a federal senator versus a Federal Elections Committee member. And that case established that really money is the same as speech for campaign finance. You really can't speak politically unless you have some money. It also established some very important principles that our law is based on. For example, you can't limit the amount of money a candidate can spend on their own campaign. You can't limit the amount that a candidate can spend at all on the campaign from any source. You can limit individual contributions, and you can require disclosure. In Minnesota, you probably all think we have spending limits, or if you think about it, you know we really don't. Voluntary. They're voluntary because they cannot constitutionally be mandatory. So only if you sign a public subsidy agreement do you have a spending limit. And only if you sign a public subsidy agreement are you limited on how much of your own money you can use to support your campaign, because both of those things are constitutionally protected and can only be limited on a voluntary basis. The public subsidy program, along with the limits that we have in place, have had a big effect in Minnesota, which has some of the lowest cost elections in the country. A study was done of 33 states in 2006. These were states where the governor was up for election. In Minnesota, 60% of all the money raised was from people giving $250 or less. That was the highest percent of any of those 33 states. In Minnesota, the percent of money coming from large donors and non-party entities was the lowest of those 33 states, only 24%. So that shows you that somehow our system has resulted in small individual donors being the largest source of money for state elections. Another interesting thing in 2006, in Minnesota, 4.11% of the population of registered voters or eligible voters actually donated to a campaign, and that was the fourth highest of those 33 states. So something in our system is encouraging individual participation. Part of it might have been the contribution refund program. Part of it might be Minnesota's culture. People who will come before the various committees and talk about public subsidy programs and defend them will say that they're important for two reasons. One, to keep the overall cost of elections down so candidates aren't spending all of their time raising money. And certainly that's been effective in Minnesota. The 6th congressional district, the federal race, the candidates raised more than $15 million for this single race. On the other hand, in District 15B, which one of your members hails from and is sort of some of that same area, the winning candidate raised before the general election just over $25,000, the losing candidate just around $13,000. Without some sort of program that can keep these amounts down, I would predict, that people who talk to you will certainly predict, that the cost of elections in Minnesota will go up and your time will be spent in fundraising. Finally, just one last item. What's it all cost? The portion of the public subsidy program that results in direct payments to you from the state managed through the Campaign Finance Board, which is determined by a checkoff system, but it's not the people's money they're checking off. They're directing money from the general fund to candidates and districts. That costs about $3.5 million per biennium every 2 years. The contribution refund program, when it was in full effect, cost about $10 or $11 million per biennium. So you're talking about somewhere in the $14 million per biennium cost for those combined programs. So that's just something to keep in mind as people start to come and advocate for and against those programs. The whole system in Minnesota has been successful if its goal is to encourage participation and keep cost of elections down. If you want to take more time, I'm happy to stay for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. We're about out of time, but Representative Erdahl had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quickly, have you noticed a big change in contributions since the discontinuance of the contribution program?
Not a huge change, although there will be in 2010 because, of course, it's totally defunded right now. The funding runs on a fiscal year, whereas the program runs on a calendar year. So the defunding for the biennium that we're in right now was only partially effective because for calendar year 2009, they could still get their contribution for the first 6 months before it was defunded. So for that, for the two-year period we're in now, about $3.7 million has been given back as opposed to the normal $10 or $11 million. So there's definitely some savings because this calendar year there are no refunds. The other effect we've noticed, and this is anecdotal, but we know that there are many fewer contribution refunds being given, and we have heard from candidates, particularly new candidates, who were unable to raise enough qualifying contributions to qualify for public subsidy, and they typically relied on this refund program to do that. So some people were shut out of the public subsidy program. Now, one might question whether you shouldn't be able to raise $30, $50 contributions without people getting their money back, but we did see that happen.
Representative Simon?
Just quickly, if you could just give us the price tag, how much does the subsidy program cost per year, per calendar year? I suppose it depends on, well, in the election year. And then how much roughly is the PCR program during its last year of operation?
The public subsidy program costs about $3.4 million, $3.5 million per biennium. what we actually pay out varies by who's up for election, but that's the amount it costs per biennium, and anything that's not paid out will carry forward to the next time that particular group of candidates is up for election. And if fully funded and used, as it has been historically over the last several years, this contribution refund program would be between 10.5 and 11 million per 2 years.
Mr. Chair, just a quick...
Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. The bill, as I understand it, before us right now, before the House, would abolish the program as opposed to the practice in effect over the last year and a half, which is just to not fund it but leave the program intact. The bill that's before us would actually get rid of it, so there would be no hope, short of resurrecting the program, of ever funding it again. I think that's something we've got to really think about.
Mr. Chair, members, that's my understanding as well. What I might point out is that this is a program that is established and funded in statute, so it doesn't have to go through the biennial budget process. The program will automatically become reinstated on July 1st unless the legislature actually amends that particular statute.
Well, Mr. Goldsmith, thank you for being here today, and particularly for the new members, don't ever be hesitant in contacting Campaign Finance Board on any question that you or your campaign manager or treasurer may have. We've had many, many contacts there, and they've always done a very good job of responding to questions. So with that, members, we meet again on Tuesday, and our subject is pensions. So get ready.
Get ready.
Meeting adjourned.
Can I have...